and welcome everyone to our very first episode of Carpe Diem. I'm Alexei Othanen-Girard.
And I'm Meredith SK. And our very special guest this week is Chris Hawkabout, a game designer, player, world builder extraordinaire, currently at Telltale Games, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
Hello. And you've made your own game system as well, that's right?
Yes. Yeah, I did get my own RPG published through Art House, which was White Wolf's independent label.
And what was the name of the game?
The name of that game was The Secret of Zeron.
So this is a podcast about learning how to be a dungeon master or a game master. I've wanted to become a DM and be able to run my own games for several years now. And I've always felt like it was a pretty obtuse and intimidating subject to learn. And so we're going to be here every other week. Alexei is going to be teaching me, and hopefully we're going to be teaching everyone else how to become a DM. Alexei, can you tell me about your experience?
Yeah, I started playing role-playing games when I was about 17, so it's been about 20 years. It's definitely sort of the hobby that I have been doing the longest, the thing that, as a leisure activity, I'm probably most committed to in my life. And, it's funny because I learned how to DM by running campaigns for friends when I was in high school, and just sort of like diving in and not really knowing what I was doing and crashing and burning my first couple games spectacularly, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later. But as an adult, I think the desire to sort of like, you always have to be willing to fail, but having someone else to show you, hey, avoid my rookie pitfalls, I think is really worthwhile. So
I really like your description of it as a leisure activity, because going into this, I have a pretty high amount of anxiety, and I don't know if it's because I've just been, I guess, blessed to have so many amazing GMs around, but just the breadth of it and the just like immense scope of it, and seeing Alexei do like how intense he is on his world building, and Chris like has journals full of little drawings of characters and creatures. So I just want to say real quick that we're going to have a format to these shows, and it'll be evolving. This is our first show,
very first one,
and also our first podcast
ever, so
we're very professional.
Yeah.
I used a sock in the pop mic. I'm very excited about it. But the general format will be that every week I'll be reading a portion of the Dungeon Master's Guide, which we'll also refer to as the DMG. So in case acronyms seriously suck, we know, but we'll try to keep you informed. So the first section will be me. I'll be reading a section of the DMG and asking Alexei questions that might pop up in that time where I don't understand how it would be integrated, or I don't understand why it's important, or something might be vague. And then the second section, Alexei will be telling us about sort of theory of game design around that subject.
Yeah, I think it'll be a little bit more of a freeform discussion about sort of how to take the stuff that we talked about in the first section and, expand it or apply it in different ways or other things to think about, the broader context. I love D&D, but there are a lot of other great games out there. So I want to make sure that people who are, getting into the hobby know that there's sort of a big breadth of stuff. But definitely the first few episodes, we're going to be focusing on the DMG and on the fifth edition of Dungeons & Dragons.
Right. So later on, we'll go on to other game formats. And what would you even like describe that? So there's different types of role-playing games. These are all tabletop
all tabletop role-playing games, unless we want to go totally crazy and run a live action game, but
that would be amazing. Like there's parts of this where I don't even necessarily know all the terms. I'm like,
sure.
Okay, RPG versus tabletop
RPG?
Same thing.
Almost synonymous, I guess. RPG is a little bit broader because it encompasses live action, which is like tabletop, except generally you're like standing up and walking around.
I need one of those trees.
Yeah, we need a Venn diagram. A Venn diagram would
really
do
you think of that? Yeah, I mean, there's not like sort of like a little
like a philology tree.
So yeah, that'll be the second section, yeah. And then we'll have a monster of the week every week where we go over, we're going to have a wheel of monsters, yeah. To choose a monster at random to talk about.
Just
that
sort of
monster.
A, like these are the iconic monsters of this system, you know, get familiar with them and talk a little bit about, you know, how can you use this in your campaign and what, you know, monster is kind of this broad, weird word, especially mm-hmm. in Dungeons and Dragons, which in the latest edition has a great line, which says that monsters are any type of creature or human, which is kind of like, oh, people are monsters. So just
really? You know.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Humans count as monsters in Dungeons and Dragons.
That's either really heavy or really confusing.
Yeah.
I think that's what makes game, what I love about Call of Cthulhu, or at least the way I play Call of Cthulhu, which is my campaigns tend to have very few, if ever, any monsters.
Huh.
Yeah. And yeah. So that their impact is greater and there's plenty of monstrous humans.
Right. There will be the monster of the week. So eventually I'll find a sort of Wheel of Fortune TM, whoever owns it, sort of sound effect of the tick, 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 tick. It's going to be really exciting, and I'll have to make, you know, I'm sure there's a website somewhere where I can program in a bunch of things that'll make the noise, and that'll be that.
Fix it in post.
Fix it in post. This is the motto of the podcast now, is fix it in post. I don't know how to do anything in post yet.
And then our third segment is going to be our guest focus. So, again, today we have Chris Hockabout, and that'll be a chance for us to get sort of another perspective on the stuff that we've been talking about and hear a little bit about, you know, other people's experiences running Dungeons & Dragons, but also maybe running other games. Mm-hmm.
And
about
what did you...
What
battle stories?
What? Oh, war stories.
War
stories.
Apparently this is a thing.
Oh, it's totally a thing. War stories are when you get together with other people who have like played role-playing games and you sit down and you tell about a character who died in a particularly spectacular fashion,
right.
Or, you know, like recount the tales that you've sort of lived through or imagined your way through. So,
so this being our very first episode, we're going to start very at the basics.
Yeah.
I have in front of me... D&D Dungeon Master's Guide, everything a dungeon master needs to weave legendary stories for the world's greatest role-playing game. I purchased this book off of Amazon. It's still, maybe you can even hear the crack from the spine. No, maybe not. It smells good, though. So I have just purchased this book. What do I do now? Sounds like a question that I made up, but this is actually kind of, you know, like there's a bunch of chapters. Do I read it front to back?
So I think that I have a friend, actually the person who taught me how to play role-playing games, who I casually mentioned at one point that I had picked up a game and was going to run it for some friends. And his response was, but you haven't played it first? And I was like, no, it's a little boutique game that I got. No one's really played it. I'm just going to run it. And he was kind of aghast. Like, he was sort of taken aback that... He's like, I don't understand how you could run a game for someone that you hadn't played first, right? And to a certain extent, I think that what he was talking about, while I don't necessarily agree all the time, because sometimes you just have to throw yourself into something and figure it out as you go.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what he was getting at was that having that experience of play can be really important to sort of inform you. And definitely... As a DM, one of the most important things that you do is sort of know the rules. So I would definitely say that before you do anything with the DMG, you gotta have read the player's handbook, right? The that's your baseline. Having said that, we're assuming that, you know, you here and whatever listeners we have at home or wherever, that they've already done that. So
I mean, how well... Mm-hmm. Should you only become a DM? Is it only really feasible when you've been doing it for like a really long time and you know exactly what stat you need to roll four,
but you got to know the basics. Okay. I think it's not necessary for the DM to be like a perfect expert on every possible rule. Mm-hmm. But, you know, having a sense of how does this game approach sort of moving characters around and understanding like sort of how those characters interact with the game world, having that is really important.
Okay.
So have that skill. Then once you've done that, and we'll probably talk a little bit more about those kinds of things when we move into our episodes about things like combat, which is, you know, especially in Dungeons and Dragons, it's like the place where a lot of that happens. Like you have to know the difference between, you know, an attack roll and a saving throw and a skill check. Those are your three big things. There are also three different types of actions that you should know about. Anyway.
Chris, what do you think?
You know, really the only thing that it takes to be a game master really is that you have a story you want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And often I think the best way is to, when you think, I have a story I want to tell, okay, what do I need to know to tell that story? Are they going to take a trip? All right, maybe I should look in the book. Is there any rules on taking trips, mm-hmm. what travel is like? Or, okay, well, I mean, maybe inclement weather, that seems like something's more. Do they have rules for that?
Mm-hmm.
I want to point out that I just, whatever that little feeling is mm-hmm. of a new bit of knowledge being formed in your mm-hmm. brain, I just had that. And I think that's like the first one yeah. for this show.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put in some sort of sound effect okay. later on. There's going to be a confetti sound effect.
Yeah, so ultimately mm-hmm. the DMG is a set of rules that are going to help you kind of formulate and tell the story that you want to tell.
Okay.
The other part, and the thing that I think might be even sort of as important is, it's a little bit of a chicken egg situation, right? Do you have the story that you want to tell before you have the players that you want to tell it to? Or do you identify the players that you want to play with and then figure out what story is going to work for them or what story, you know, is going to get them really excited.
Right.
Both of those are really important.
Okay. So I've got my book here.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, as books tend to do, have a bunch of chapters broken up into larger parts.
Mm-hmm.
Do I read it front to back?
Yeah, totally.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I think for a first pass through, reading the DMG front to back is not a bad idea. Because at the very least, it'll give you a sense of where everything in the book is. In general, the player's handbook, when I play games, when I'm playing D&D, you know, we'll have three or four copies of the player's handbook out during game. But the Dungeon Master's Guide is really something that you don't need during game. You need it between games. Because it's helping you kind of guide and shape the story.
So I just turned to a random mm-hmm. page.
Section.
Random section. And it's all about different types of rings.
Yeah.
And then I turned to another page and it's all about different types of swords, it looks like.
So you've hit upon the sweet spot in the DMG, which is the treasure section.
Yep.
Oh, so this is for when you loot.
Yep.
Okay.
This is for that. Those are lists of magical items that you can sort of place in your game to offer to players. And you know, you can read through that section and maybe you'll find a weapon or a magical artifact that you get really inspired by and you want to tell a story about mm-hmm. that.
Okay.
Or at the end of that section, there's a whole other second section about loot tables. So, you know, if your players are wandering through some deviously constructed dungeon that you've built for them, and they, you know, heroically slay some poor benighted monster that's stuck there because of your devilish whimsy, you can reward them for their murder hoboing.
I'm really... So, there's something in here called an ebony fly, and it sounds awesome.
Yeah,
This ebony statuette is carved in the likeness of a horsefly, which that's horrifying to begin with. But it can become a giant flyer for up to 12 hours and can be ridden as a mount.
Who doesn't want to ride around on a giant flyer for 12 hours?
Right? But the weird thing is that it doesn't say you can inflict horrible pain on other people, because that's all I think about when I think of horseflies.
I think even a giant horsefly would not be, like, particularly dangerous.
So this guide, then, it's what I was expecting was that front to back, it was all do these things specifically to become a DM.
Nope.
It is. It's
a resource.
Yep.
Okay. So, God, I'm going to sound like, I feel like I'm going to sound like such a putz for most of this podcast.
No.
But
all got to learn somewhere.
I'll really not read the comments ever. That's my, that's the other motto. Right,
in the sense that the one you absolutely have to read, you cannot escape reading, would be the Player's Handbook.
Okay.
Because as the rules that the players will be using, it's the mechanics the players will use, it's one of the ones you're going to be using the most.
Okay.
And because the players, in order to enjoy the game, have to have a relatively frictionless experience, they can't keep running up against mechanics they don't understand. Mm-hmm. They need the game master to understand the mechanics and be able to navigate that for them when things get a little rough.
Okay.
The Dungeon Master's Guide is, as it says, it's a guide. And so it's full of resources that you need to do everything that you need to do as a game master. I would recommend that you read it cover to cover.
Okay.
Because surely inspiration lies on every page. Anytime you read something, you're going to find something that's going to go, oh, yeah, I can do something with that. That'll be cool.
Can I give you an example?
Okay.
So let's say that you have set up a situation where your players are traversing an exterior ledge of a castle in the lashing rain. They have their backs to an unfeeling stone wall, and at their toes is a rushing river, right? So those players have sort of a series of rules that they're going to interact with. How good are we at kind of moving across this little ledge? And all of those rules are going to be in the player's handbook. How good are we at moving across the ledge? Oh no, someone failed and they fell into the river. How good are they at swimming? Oh, they've been swept downstream, right? How good are they at not drowning? How good are they at not drowning? But then you, the GM, are going to have to answer the question, well, where does that player end up? Mm-hmm. Where does that stream go? And what happens to the player then? I mean, sure, maybe they drown, but assuming that they reach the other side of the bank, you need to know what's there. And the DMG is going to have resources that will help you, maybe, especially in those moments where you didn't plan for any of the players to make it to the other side. The DMG has some resources that maybe will get you thinking about, oh, well, maybe there's a bandit camp, mm-hmm. because there's some rules about, building quick bandit camps. One of the best parts of the 5th edition DMG is a series of tables that let you basically roll up or randomly generate kind of little societies. And it tells you a little bit about, who their leaders are and what their goals are and what they're doing. And those can be a lifesaver if you're, in the middle of play and things take a sharp right turn that you didn't expect. And all of a sudden you're like, I didn't think they would want to parlay with the merchant consortium, and I don't have any idea what the merchants are like.
Yeah, so. I mean, that's one part of it that is not like terrifying to me, but it's not it's something that I'm definitely more like, how do I even accomplish? Like the sort of like quick changes, it feels like I have to know not just like every little thing in the world, but every little thing in the book and things. Like it's like, oh, I did not, like I made 4 options for them that felt like a lot, and then they took the 5th one, and now I have no idea what to do.
I think that a good description of being a DM is sitting down, doing a ton of planning work, and then coming to the table and having to be really okay with the fact that your players will set that planning work on fire, push it out a window, and then drown it in a swamp.
Um. What I want to say also for the show is that as I go through this, I have a world that I'm creating for to do a campaign, because that's why I'm here. So
absolutely the best way to learn how to DM is to DM. Like, hands down, 100%, the best way to do it is just
very tautological.
So, yes. So we are, part of what we're going to be doing in this podcast is Meredith is going to be talking about her campaign ideas, and we're going to be sort of going through them and, you know, sort of breaking them apart and tweaking them a little bit and thinking about, you know, how's that actually going to wind up in play? What's that going to feel like, et cetera.
Okay.
So tell us about your campaign idea,
Meredith. Okay. Yeah. So, it's like a little bud.
It's just a seed.
It's a little polyp. It's a little seed. It's a so good little seed. It's small. A giant tortoise with an inn or a pub at the top, because I've sort of heard this trope of everyone meeting in a pub. And this tortoise with an inn on top wanders the world. I don't know why yet. I don't know where he's going yet.
Sure.
I don't know the mechanics of the people who live on there or how the players might wind up there. So let's say I have this little polyp, this small little seed.
It's your seed.
What's the next step? Do I start with little things in a linear way, or do I go top down world? Like, here's this thing. Make the universe.
In order to make an apple pie, et cetera, et cetera. I think different GMs have different styles. You know, Dungeons and Dragons, certain games even kind of help you through this process by giving you more structure around how you build your world, or who, you know, how things connect in your world. But Dungeons and Dragons is pretty old school. It gives you a rule system, and it doesn't give you a lot of world building, right? Dungeons and Dragons is kind of what we might call a generic role playing game system, not to be confused with the actual generic universal role playing game system GURPS, which is a different system.
I am so confused right now.
So
all right.
So this idea is like Dungeons and Dragons is a set of mechanics, and you, the DM, decide. In my world, there's a giant turtle with an inn on it, and the mechanics are like, okay, well, here's how you might model a giant turtle, and here's how you might model an inn.
Okay. So,
but it's up to you to think about what the story is going to be.
But on a practical level,
right?
I've got this idea for a sort of worldish location. What's my next step?
Well, I mean, the next step would be, stories sort of hinge on conflict. What's the conflict? Is the inn under threat? Is the inn a haven? Is it a safe place where people who are in trouble may flee to? Or is the owner secretly a villain who entraps people who come to that inn?
So I've got this idea for this world. Is like, it's not even an idea of a world, it's sort of, you know, like a landscape in my head and a giant tortoise and a pub. So that says something about me, I guess. What's the next thing I do? Do I create characters? Do I create a story? Like, how do I interact with this book?
Well, sure. I mean, look at the just start. Imagine, I mean, this is a place you've never been to before. So start asking yourself these questions. Well, who owns this place?
Okay.
And then come up with the answer to that. Talking about NPC or NPC creation, this is a perfect opportunity for that. You could say, okay, well, what is the owner of this place like? What do they want to do with this tavern? You know, is it because they love to offer tasty victuals and drinks to their guests?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it because the tavern is really a covert intelligence gathering operation where the whole place is bugged and adventurers tell their stories here and they get recorded and get funneled off to somewhere. Who knows?
I think that there are two ways to go about it, right? You can do a ton of world building, and the danger there is potentially nobody sees the world building that you've built. But it gives you a lot of structure for when players do something unexpected in game. You have a lot of kind of places where you can say, oh, I know this thing should happen.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can build very loosely, you know, and just sort of like improv whatever is happening when the players are interacting with your world. But you have to be really careful that your improv doesn't contradict itself in a way that okay. will make your world sort of like not logical or not
or feel sort of kitchen sinky.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In addition to the sort of rules and framework of Dungeons and Dragons, mm-hmm. I'm getting that a good first step is to kind of create a rules and framework of the world I'm in.
Yeah.
Okay. In a sense that, you know, create just as much world to tell the story you want to tell.
Okay.
And this speaks to something Alexei mentioned before, which was knowing your players. If you have players that you know are really more proactive, action-oriented, they want to explore a world. Mm-hmm. If you know that about them, then maybe having it, you know, yeah, you guys are all employees of this magical tavern, and you have a really hard boss, and it's all about dealing with that. Mm-hmm. I'm working in a magical place. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if they're not really into that, then your right. stories kind of can go off the rails really quickly.
If they're super excited about exploring this like rich world that you've created, yeah. but their boss punishes them anytime they leave the tavern, oh man, they will be so annoyed, yeah. right?
Okay.
So that's, I think that, again, that's where we get back to this idea of, do you build the game first or do you choose the players first? You know, right. whichever one you do, if you have a clear sense of your play style, if you have a clear sense of kind of like what kind of game you want to tell or play or what kind of story you want to tell, you can go to your players and say, hey, do you want to sign up for this type of story?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whereas right. if you, or you can go to your players and say, hey, what kind of story do you want to play? And then they can tell you. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really important. And actually, I've picked this up as part of my sort of DMing practice is being really explicit with my players about what kind of story they're getting themselves into.
Okay.
You know, and being like, hey, Meredith is a player in my Unknown Armies game. And I sent out an email to all of my players saying, you know, Unknown Armies is a modern occult horror role-playing game. And it gets played sort of at the lightest levels, it can feel a little bit like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But then at its darkest levels, it can be sort of this like unending psychological torment.
Like a Cronenberg film.
Yeah, like a Cronenberg film.
Cronenberg world.
So finding, you know, we had a good discussion with the players about like, where are people comfortable and what, you know, what kinds of things are they going to be excited about? Rather than me saying, okay, come to my house to have fun playing a role-playing game. And they get there and it's like, you know, your mother has turned into a monster and she's trying to eat you. Let's talk about that. Like, woo, fun. It's yeah. like, that could be really like okay. jarring for people. So
between this podcast and the mm-hmm. next episode, I'm going to sort of give myself the homework of trying to create a basic framework for this world. Mm-hmm. Why and how that inn exists to begin with.
Yeah.
How the, like, maybe not like where or why it's going, but like some basic functions of like where does water and food come from?
Yeah. Or, big picture, you know, if you tell me there's an inn on the back of a tortoise, mm-hmm. the first questions that I'm going to have about the world are, where did this tortoise come from mm-hmm. and why does it have an inn on its back?
Okay.
Right? Like those are the fantastical elements mm-hmm. that you're presenting in your game.
And so should I also have something of like how my players got there, or is that like way later?
I wouldn't say necessarily way later, but for now, think about it as you're building the scaffolding, the architecture of the okay. world that you're going to put your players in.
Okay.
Keeping them front and center is important.
Okay.
So as early as you can, think about why are they there? And especially, Dungeons & Dragons is kind of not exactly unique in this, but it's very interested in the players as heroes.
Okay.
Right? So think about, like, what are the heroic things that your players, why are your players in a special, what's the special relationship that they have to the tortoise and the ant, right? They're probably not like barmaid to, you know, barman to, you know, like servant.
Because they're not just at like some random,
right?
Like, unless, they're up on a giant turtle.
So. Yeah, exactly. I mean, unless there's an interesting, fun, exciting thing about being the support staff, not even like the front of house staff, but like the support staff on the inn on the giant turtle, which there could be. But as you start to build your world, definitely keep your players in mind. But I would say like that's like we're at step one, and that's probably step two.
Okay.
But it's not later than that.
Let's kind of go on. Like, we've talked a little bit about like some of the mechanics and sort of what I'm going to do between now and the next episode. Let's have...
What's that thing? Let's have a peek. Monster of the week.
The monster of the week. Oh my god!
Monster of the week.
Okay. So this, because we haven't, and by we, I mean me, I've failed on getting a noise effect of like the spinning click, 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 click wheel. We're doing a gelatinous cube per sort of my request. So y'all want to tell me about the gelatinous cube?
The gelatinous cube is a gelatinous creature of the ooze category that measures roughly 10 feet in a cube shape, is translucent, and moves through dungeon corridors, sweeping up detritus along the way, particularly living detritus in the form of adventurers who might see a gelatinous cube from a distance, not realize what they're looking at because being transparent, they might see the treasures suspended within it, and as it approaches, or they approach it, they suddenly realize their error as they are enveloped in paralytic slime and slowly, digested.
Yeah.
Why do I have it in my mind that this is like the canonical first creature?
It's a pretty iconic Dungeons and Dragons monster. It's one of the very few monsters that's that was kind of like really unique to the D&D ecosystem, and you can tell that because if you go back to, I think it debuted in third edition, although it might have been earlier than that.
No, it was way back in the
it was original.
Yeah.
Almost every like unique Dungeons and Dragons monster in its description has the phrase, this monster was developed by a mad wizard, which is like one of my favorite things about early D&D, which was that there were all of these kind of like offhand references to a world that your players were in, but they were never elaborated on. So like the identity of this mad wizard, why it made this thing, why the wizard thought this was a good idea. None of those are ever explained. Just like the bugbear is a good, or the owlbear actually is even better. Like the owlbear is a bear with a owl's head, and it's like a mad wizard made this thing.
Actually, the gelatinous cube belongs to also a an unheralded classification of monsters called the fuck you players.
Yeah, it's true.
Oh.
Along with the lurker above, which is basically a creature that is a ceiling that comes down.
Yeah,
on
it
you.
Comes down and eats you.
The
rust monster.
A rust monster which eats your armor.
Armor and weapons.
There's the enveloper. I can't remember. It's a
cloaker.
It's basically the floor.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of the lurker above. It's just a it's floor just that is a creature that eats you.
Oh, and of course the mimic. The ultimate fuck you monster. A mimic looks like a treasure chest until you try to open it, and then it grows teeth and eats you.
Yeah. Nice.
So it's like you fight your way through the dungeon. You're at the end of a corridor. There's a treasure chest. The thief is like, I got this one. Goes over, tries to pick the lock. Garm, no more thief. You got eaten by a mimic.
And combined that with a gelatinous cube, and
right,
like, more like fuck you GM.
So when would I use a gelatinous cube?
So a gelatinous cube, the thing that I love about the gelatinous cube is that it's created by a mad wizard, but has a like logical, a quasi-logical function in the ecology of a dungeon. It had become a convention of the genre that dungeon corridors were exactly 10 feet wide by 10 feet high. That is the exact dimensions of the gelatinous cube. So the idea of a gelatinous cube is that it sort of like oozes its way slowly down a corridor, as Chris said, picking up organic detritus, dissolving anything organic, and then anything inorganic gets suspended inside the cube. it's a trash compactor. Like, it doesn't really have a will. It doesn't really have a personality. It just sort of, like, slurps down the corridor and eats anything that comes in its way. It's a neat monster to throw, partly because it's got that kind of old school D&D flavor, but also because it depends on a couple of factors about dungeons that players don't often think about. Like, there's not a lot of light in a dungeon generally. So when you see something at the end of a corridor and it's moving towards you, but it's not really clear what it is, players will like invent a bunch of things about what it might be. Mm-hmm. And if they don't see it, then it just sort of like slowly slurps over them and picks them up, paralyzes them, and eats them. So,
or perhaps there's a gelatinous cube containing the skeleton of a recently eaten person and is backlit by a distant torch. So all the looks players like, see look is
so
like
it's
this,
clear,
looks
clear.
Like a skeleton.
In my head, it's like greenish.
No, it's traditionally, gelatinous cubes are actually like translucent or transparent. They're hard to see.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So it's like sort of like a cloaking shield type translucent, not like a glistening sheen of gel.
It's gelatin.
Yeah. It's like agar. I always imagined it as just like clear agar, sort of like slowly slurping down the corridor. You would use it if you wanted your players to be angry at you or just angry in general.
But at the same time, they are sort of a
I mean, are they hard to kill?
They're tricky because they're oozes are by nature hard.
Oozes, slimes, and puddings. Oozes, slimes, and
puddings.
Wait,
there's creatures called puddings?
Back in third edition there was. Yeah.
The dreaded black pudding.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Okay, one day. Some other day. Yeah.
But the players also love gelatinous cubes because they have treasure inside of them. Mm-hmm. And you can see it. You can go, oh crap, there's a freaking magic dagger in there.
I play a lot of rogues, and I hate oozes, slimes, puddings, golems. Anything that doesn't have like anatomy that I can stab, I'll just dip out of a battle because I'm like, I'm useless. Like if it doesn't have a spleen or a kidney that I can stab, I'm
of its own. I mean, imagining there might be spleens or kidneys in there,
but they're not anatomically necessary for the gelatinous cube. And it's just like, you know, killing a gelatinous cube is a long process. You have to like hack at it a bunch, probably like set it on fire.
So you just like hack it to pieces until it's not a cube anymore.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Eventually it'll sort of like, slime out and then you can take all the goodies inside.
Well, I think this is a pretty good, I think I know about the gelatinous cube now.
Yeah.
So one thing you can always tell the players to sort of inform them of what lies ahead is, as they're exploring these dungeon corridors, you can tell them, these dungeon corridors seem strangely clean.
Oh, yeah. Seem unnaturally clean. That is the tell. That's the absolute, the tell of the gelatinous cube is, and again, why would you make a gelatinous cube? Well, let's say that you're an insane wizard and you have a dungeon, but you're tidy.
Yeah.
You don't want it to get manky. It gets gross. Mosses grow. Gross. You make a gelatinous cube, it
rats
just
leave droppings all over the place.
Yeah, ugh, gross. Super gross.
Let's move on to Chris. I would like to...
Should we give him a surprise?
Oh yeah, what? Chris. I'm very excited because I finally got a copy of Secret of Zoran.
You got my RPG.
Because I want to ask you about your sort of story of becoming a DM and writing guides and what sort of advice you have for a budding young DM. And anything else, like you're our special guest for a reason. You're extremely talented, and
from the first moment I played it, it just sort of struck a chord.
How old were you when you
was 10?
Wow.
Nine. Nine, a week from 10. Mm-hmm. And I'm the first character I made died. got killed in the first dungeon he ever went into, but I was undaunted. I kind of went home, and
my first character got eaten by a giant scorpion.
Yeah, I was a magic user in second edition D&D, so I fired my one magic missile at the first orc I found, and that was basically okay. You're done for the day.
Was that it? Yeah.
And then I fell into a subterranean river and hit my head on a stalactite, got knocked unconscious, and drowned.
You never forget your first, you know? your first hideous death.
Yeah. And but I just I took to it like just immediately, and because I had stories I guess I wanted to tell, and because I wound up being like the only kid among my friends who was actually eager to be the dungeon master. And I was also kind of a shy kid, and being a dungeon master was a way for me to express myself and to feel comfortable talking to other people. And and that first year was all Dungeons and Dragons, and I had this monumentous event happen at the end of that first year where I kind of had an epiphany, and I learned all the other role-playing games are out there, starting with Call of Cthulhu, and just Call of Cthulhu, I think, was what really taught me how to game master a story, because in Dungeons & Dragons, of course, I was building up my vocabulary of place and of character and being able to express things in visual language and taking players to a place. Mm. Call of Cthulhu taught me about how to build suspense and mystery, and also how the pursuit of knowledge and investigation and a sense of discovery was more important than experience points or treasure or killing monsters. Mm. And it's so Call of Cthulhu sort of broke me of that mold. And from that point on, I was like ardent gamer and convention attendee, and first got my opportunity to do artwork for Cyberpunk 2020 from Artelsorian Games. It was a game I really got into because I came up during the 70s and 80s, and I saw The Warriors and Blade Runner on the same day, and I went home and I made a role-playing game called Gang War, which was where you played not a single character but a whole gang. I made a character sheet that had like entries for each member of your gang, 10 or 11.
Oh my god.
And it was set in a dystopia where I remember writing, "We're crossing the street is the same as, you know, walking across through a war zone, you know." And this is before Cyberpunk came out. When Cyberpunk came out, I was like, yeah, okay, I'm totally there. And I started making like little booklets for my game group that had all kinds of new stuff in it. And then who walks into the back of my game store but Mike Pondsmith, who's the writer of creator of Cyberpunk, and Mechton, which is a great mech role-playing game. And also Castle Falkenstein, which is this excellent diceless game system where it doesn't use dice at all, uses playing cards. Yeah. Use playing cards as a resolution mechanic. And it's set in this amazing steampunk world, which is why I kind of turn my nose up at steampunkers these days, because I was like, where were you guys in 1986? You know, were you reading Paul DiFilippo?
I don't think so.
Anyway. And so I started doing art for them, and that really kind of I grew as an artist under them, and I did their magazine, and from then on I just kind of got to meet all my favorite game designers. I met like Greg Stafford and Sandy Peterson, who were big in Chaosium, who were makers of RuneQuest and Call of Cthulhu. My great hero David R. Hargrave, who created the Arduin world, and which is this amazing.
I have Arduin Grimoire.
Yeah, that's sort of the Rifts before Rifts or Cinnabar. The sort of like uber fantasy world, but his books captivated me in terms of world building. They were invaluable because he would spend exhaustive sections on describing to in extreme detail foods and liqueurs and metals and precious gemstones.
So how did that evolve into you becoming a game designer? I mean, obviously that was all game design, but like, how did that evolve into working in video game industry?
Well, role-playing games were the muse that fired my art, my writing, and my illustration and my art is what got me my first game industry gig working for Spectrum Holobyte, and from there to LucasArts. But I'd been designing role-playing games. I designed my first tabletop role-playing game when I was 10 after reading a book of Irish mythology. I created a role-playing game set in mythological Ireland. And so designing games is always what I wanted to do. But in the game industry in the early 90s, when I got into it, the video game industry, there was no game designer position. If you wanted to technically design a game, meaning you wanted to contribute to what made it fun, what you played, what the story was, what you did, but not necessarily, you know, program it, you either came up through art or design. Mm-hmm. And being an artist, that was my track. And then as the medium of video games matured and designing video games became its own discipline, I made the leap from art to design, which at that time was not much done because a lot of the artists in the game industry at that time came out of art school. Mm-hmm. And they weren't about to toss away, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of art school education so they could write
design documents.
Yeah. You know. The thing that predicated my move into design at LucasArts was the publishing of my first tabletop RPG, The Secret of Zoran.
I thought you worked at Lucas before you did Zoran.
Oh, I did, yeah. But I was an artist at LucasArts for many, many years.
Like a 3D artist? Yeah. Or I mean, I knew you then, and I should know this, but I don't.
I was their first texture artist. Mm. Worked on Dark Forces and Jedi Knight and Shadows of the Empire and and then I left LucasArts. I did my own thing for a while, and I came back to LucasArts. I was an artist still. I got my RPG published, and they found, and people elsewhere, designers in the company, heard that I'd published my own RPG. Mm. RPG, and they're like, "Shit, we're doing an RPG. We need to get Hawk about in here." Mm-hmm. And I've been a game designer ever since then.
And but so, what games have you been a like principal role of?
Like lately?
I don't know. Like, which ones are you proud of?
I'd say probably the one I'm proud of most is the work I did on City of Heroes, the original superhero MMO.
RPG, yeah.
And I came into it late in its life cycle, but I got to create design from the ground up, the lore, although there was a lore to base it on, but I created everything. Like the map layout and factions and mm-hmm. and mythology and everything from the ground up for the Pretoria, which was like the last 20 levels of content that was released for City Heroes before it closed. And it was just an amazing experience working there too. And because City Heroes was late in its cycle, all of its fans were, of course, all the long-lasting Evergreen fans. Mm-hmm. And they were awesome. Any City Heroes fans listening to this, you guys were always nothing but the best. And I normally hate video game fans. They're mostly
the quote of the evening, I think.
Yeah, the medium has undergone some pretty significant shifts in the last few years. Yeah.
So what advice would you give folks like myself who are really just getting started learning being any sort of game master or DM or...
You know, I kind of what it comes back to always is what's the story you want to tell, you mm-hmm. know? Do you have in your head, you know, someone in peril who needs help? You know, is it a story of personal discovery? It all comes down to, you have a story in your head. You don't even have to know where the story is going, but you at least know where the kickoff point is, and you maybe know where the heading is, where it's going to be going to. And the players are really there because you want to share with them this idea that you have, and it's a gift. You're giving them this gift of this experience, and they are in turn giving you this gift of being the cast. In a way, the game master is sitting in the catbird seat. They're the ones sitting in the balcony of the playhouse watching the story unfold, even though it comes from their own head. You can't tell what the players are going to do. Players are going to constantly surprise you, hopefully, in the best circumstance they will. And in a sense, you're giving them opportunities to surprise you. The way I look at game mastering is I don't actually do a whole lot of preparation. I don't try to imagine every eventuality. I have in my head an event. Something is going to happen. If the players do not intercede, this is going to happen. Then with the players, I introduce the tip of the iceberg element. It's there's something, some symptom, some outward sign of what is happening that the players are going to touch upon. And it's going to be it's a hook. That's where the term comes from. It's a literal hook that draws the player's interest. Usually putting them in peril is a good way to get their attention and get them vested early.
Offer them treasure. That's always mine.
Always sort of try to, you have to build player investment, and the best way to do that, I found, is to just let them sort of explore the space a bit at their own pace until you feel ready to kind of, you know, throw them into the deep end, so to speak. So often when you're looking at a game mastering for the first time, it's maybe think about that first session.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to do? You know, what do you want to do that first time? Just get them through that first hump and then use the intervening time to be inspired by that and think about where you're going to go next or where they're going to take you next.
That's amazing. I think that I think this is a really great place to sort of like,
yeah,
like I feel like I'm kind of like much, I mean, like certainly slightly less worried and a little bit more knowledgeable. I mean, funny how those things go together.
But I will say this.
Yeah.
I'm not a big stickler for mechanics a lot of times. But why it is important to read the books cover to cover is it's good to know all the mechanics so you can know which ones are safe to dispense with.
Yep.
Oh, so it's a sort of, you don't know which rules you can break until you know them all kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I really want to thank you for coming by, Chris.
Thank you so much.
Chris is one of my oldest friends and certainly an incredibly talented and very eloquent and helpful radio guest and probably the best radio voice of the three of us tonight for sure.
Yeah, he's okay.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm excited to hear, you know, I'm excited that you're doing this. I mean, as long as we've known each other, the fact we've never gamed together is well, that's something that's going to have to be.
It's a tragedy.
Mm. Yeah, right.
No, I'm really excited. I mean, I've been very intimidated by D&D for a long time. I mean, partially because when I was growing up, I wanted to play it. And it's just really, it's almost impossible for a girl in a small town, especially when I was growing up, hopefully not as much as it used to be, to become a part of a game and have any sort of sense of acceptance, let alone, you know, move on to then lead a game. So I'm really excited to be doing it now and kind of conquering a fear, but also, you know, doing something that I feel like has been a missing part of me. And hopefully over the course of this, not only I will learn how to do it, but that maybe we can help other people who either through lack of contact or context or availability have not been able to learn how to be a DM when they wanted to, or maybe just people who, you know, haven't known where to start?
So professionally, I'm a teacher. So let's go over your homework before we before we end this episode. So before our next episode, which will be in 2 weeks, you're going to finish reading that first big picture section of the DMG, and then we can kind of talk about it.
So for next time, I'm going to read this sort of part one, chapter one, if you're reading along in your Dungeon Master's Guide.
In your DMG.
So that's chapter one, that is everything from A World of Your Own all the way to Flavors of Fantasy. And we'll kind of jump around a little bit, but those will be the things where I read, ask specific questions for, and Alexei helps me, you know, with anything that I don't quite understand.
Yeah, I think once you get through that section, you know, when I read it, I was pretty impressed with the way that Fifth Edition has kind of formulated how to think about building a campaign. So hopefully that will really inspire you to sort of take, see your adventure seed begin to put out its first roots.
As someone who's a big Pathfinder fan, I can't tell you how happy I am with Fifth Edition. I just think they really created something special. When I picked those books up, it really felt like, you know, it gave me a lot of the same sense of magic I had when I was digging into D&D books for the first time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Way to go, guys.
Yeah.
And my other homework is to create a very sort of like a few more basic framework of my Tortuga world.
Yep.
So
excellent.
Thanks, everyone.
Who's listening. all five of you, I'm sure. Chris, thank you so much for being our
guest.
Thank
you.
It's been a great way to start this podcast off.
You can find us at dmcast.net, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Bye.